How many of us are uncomfortable with the present moment as it is? How many of us squirm when we're forced to observe that which is always present, which is silence? How many of us use things and circumstances to avoid something we can never avoid, which is this breath and this present moment? And how often is this now, this moment, in the way of what I need to do with my mind? How often when we get still and we're forced about a minute or two of stillness, we get uncomfortable and we start to figure things out. I always joke around, people say he forgot what to say, he's meditating, he's in a trance. I'm still working on regime. You said regime, I don't know. But we use the present moment because it's in the way we need to get someplace else. And we're never present. We're always attached to the mind. And we think life situations are our life. And life situations are not our life. And we get so uncomfortable, and many of you looked uncomfortable for about a minute or so because I wasn't speaking and the rhythm of the meeting stopped. Here's the speaker, introduction, and off we go. And then we're busy again. We're listening to stuff. So I don't have to pay attention to me breathe. I don't have to pay attention to anything. But usually somewhere in the talk, I'm listening with one ear and I'm worried about the traffic going home with the other or the fight I'm going to have when I get home for going to another meeting. It goes on and on, the boss tomorrow, etc. Just things. And that we think is our life. That we determine, we use that as to determine what my life is, good, bad, up, down, left, or right. And none of that is true. We're living in delusion when we do that. And the present moment we never get to experience is too scary. And when things aren't going good, based on external conditions, I don't like this, I need more of that, I need less of this, I need to live here, I need to live there, there's something wrong here, I need to do this, point fingers, what I throw in is hope. Now hope at face value sounds like a wonderful thing. I hope for better things, it sounds good. But isn't hope based in fear, on an unstable foundation? I hope things get better. Why? Because where I am right now is terrible. And then we get there, and well, I hope when I get there, it's going to be okay. And we're always arriving where we don't want to arrive, that we can never escape, and that's the present moment. And so we open up a meeting with about a minute or two of stillness, and we get uncomfortable. I actually hear myself breathe, and I don't like this. Somebody do something. Somebody say something. I don't like observing silence. And yet it's that where we come from and that which we return to. And where I experience God is in the present moment. And I don't have to be still to experience a present moment. I always like to refer to little children. When we're playing with little children, we're really not concerned either if it's a couple of minutes or longer about anything else because they ooze God and we get taken right into that and we're very present in what we're doing. Some of us like to paint or do gardening and we lose ourselves in that. Some of us like to write or make music. We lose ourselves in that. Time doesn't exist. Things stop existing. We're very present because it's where we're supposed to be. In the present moment, you can't exist it. The silence we can't create. We can't create that which already exists, but we're always looking to stuff to get in the way of what's always there. And in the silence is where I experience God. And when I stop getting unhooked from hope, I need hope for this, I need hope for that, and I start to take in this moment as is and release all judgments, I get to a place where I realize that God is caring for me better than anyone or anything can. And I find safety, I find love, I find compassion, I find understanding, I find service in that moment. And suddenly I'm able to do what the carpenter said, wear the world like a loose garment. Life situations are life situations. Life circumstances are life circumstances. We could be rich today and poor tomorrow. I could have the love of my life and be divorced tomorrow. Things change. We live in a world of impermanence, and I'm always trying to lock in to something I can't get. And so this moment is always in the way. It's always in the way. When I get there, when I get here, when I get that job, when I get the money, now that sounds nice, but how am I doing right now? Because it's all I got is right now. All I have is right now, one breath at a time. And we kind of do it in AA. We tell people live the day at a time. None of us do it. You know, we mark it off the calendar and we live a day at a time as a ball and chain around my neck, another day, hanging there another day. What an awful way to live when God has given us all glory. Anyone who's locked in with God, anyone who's connected with God, has that feeling, that realization of God in their life. Time really is something you use to get to work and go home with. Pick up the kids from soccer. I remember one time I was down the Jersey Shore, and I woke up my usual 6 o'clock, and someone came into the room and looked at the clock. It was a few hours later and said, "Oh my God, it's 10 o'clock. I wanted to have breakfast early. I wanted to get to the beach early. The whole day is ruined." Wow. It's 10 o'clock in the morning. The whole day is ruined. The next day, there was a bunch of people there. I got up my usual 6 o'clock in the morning, and there was a clock above the sink in the kitchen, and I took the clock down. And I hit it. Same people walked in. They said, "Oh, the clock's missing. Hey, you guys hungry? You want to go for breakfast?" It was 10 o'clock in the morning. That's the power of the calendar. That's the power of the clock. That's the power of the thinking mind attached to everything. And then I start to volunteer to live life. At the beginning, I'm a victim. I don't know. Only know what I know. Punch a clock for life. Get attached to external conditions. My car makes me. My relationship makes me. My money makes me. My job makes me. Remove one of those things. What do we have? Nothing. There's no God in that equation. And all this work drives us back to getting right with God. So regardless of what I do for a living or how much money I do or don't have, if I'm in a relationship or I'm in the practice of celibacy for the rest of my life, everything is perfect as it is in God's eyes. And yet I keep trying to rearrange the script, try to rewrite the script and say, "God, you got it wrong. I have a better chapter here. Pay attention. I'm rich and successful and everyone loves me. Do it now." And sometimes the greatest lessons, because God's road isn't straight. Everyone, I thought God's road is straight, point A to point B. God's road is crooked sometimes. And there's things God is going to lead me down that I say, "I don't like this." It's for me to learn. And those things drive me back to God so I can be of service to the next person who's lost their way. I'm someone's compass who doesn't have one. And I need to learn life lessons, but never, ever be attached to life. Can't do it. Can't even get attached to people because the people will disappoint us. People will disappoint us. We're broken. And only with the touch of the Master's hand will we get fixed. Most people are not seeking God. We claim God with our lips, but our actions prove just the opposite. And we have right in our sacred rooms of AA a whole bunch of hypocrisy sometimes. You think about it. I claim God for now with my lips, God, 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 until I get into the parking lot and you cut me off on the way out. God, 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 God. And I say, "Do you hear what that guy said? He must be really nuts. I can't believe him." And I'm gossiping. What happened to God? If anyone can really gossip about us, it's God. Could you imagine a story he can tell you about us over a cup of coffee? Whoa. So do I use the present moment? Am I looking at the present moment as a thing that's in the way? So where does this connect into 4 and 5? It parallels all our work we do because all the work is about driving us back to God and getting unhooked from the mind. The mind is usually using me. I never get to use the mind. My ego convinces me that I had a great thought, that I'm doing something good, but the mind is driving me. And when I take credit for good things, my ego's in control. The mind drives me. The mind drives me. The mind drives me. Even when things seem to be going well, at some point the mind's going to drive me right back into a wall again. All credit goes to God. And it's about the removal of self, which is what this work is going to do. A lot of you guys know Garrett, and Garrett will go up to someone and say, "How you doing?" And he says, "Great." And he says, "Get a second opinion." Right? Because I'm using that same thinking mind as a barometer for how well I'm doing. The last person should tell you how well I'm doing is me. Let you be the judge of that. Let my God be the judge of that. And what the work does is drive me to God through the removal of self, through the unhooking of the mind. Because what we get to see in step 4, how I have and you have been playing God in every single area of our life. We assign people roles. Book says we're in the world to play the role God assigns, not the role I've assigned. I even assign God a role. I assign everyone a role. I assign me a role. And that never works, and I'm always disappointed. I have expectations, unrealistic ones, and which is fertile ground for resentment. things aren't going my way, it's your fault. Over and over and over again. And at the core of all of this is fear. The present moment, I'm in fear. I got to hope for things to get better, but on my terms, why? Because if it's not on my terms, it's probably not going to be good. Fear. And when I look back at my past, fear started the past, but I look back on it, it's all resentment. And I get bookended from resentments and fear. Anytime I look into futures, fear, I get bookended. No wonder why I need a drink just to breathe. Not very few people will do work like this, even in AA. There's a minority of us in the book, really in the book. Not window dressing with the book, but really living along spiritual lines. And the spiritual path is a very narrow one. There's not a lot of room here. It's a very narrow path. But in the narrowing of that path, we find an abundance, a tremendous amount of freedom. And I've said it from a million of these podiums. The person who wants stuff, the man who's full of greed, wants everything, notoriety, fame, money, all of it, and gets nothing. The humble man who doesn't expect much, is grateful for a meal on his table, wants nothing, and gains the world. In fact, when you ask that man or woman, all they want is to love their God and love others. That's all that, and food on the table, my family's taken care of. That's all I want out of this life. My job is to serve God. They seem to be doing great. You ever see these people who are CEOs that have all kinds of cars and they can buy anything and they're absolutely miserable. And the guy outside who's the gardener, who makes like minimum wage, is whistling to work, whistling on the way home, can't wait for Christmas, can't wait for the holidays, going to spend time with his family. And you say, why is he miserable and he has riches? This man has nothing and he loves his life. Maybe he's got a God alive in him and the other one is searching for Ben Franklin to be God. Mm-hmm. Property, prestige, money, attention, notoriety. Can't find God there because it goes away. I do this a lot. And my teachers told me early on, it's going to come a time we're going to be too old to get to a podium, so don't get attached to it. I know a lot of folks who do this. I travel the globe doing this. I know a lot of folks who live for this. This is who they are. Put anybody in front of me, give me a podium, I'll go speak. They will leave their children, their wives, their job to go do a talk because that's who they are. And my sponsors were good when they said, don't get it sassy because when you come today, you can't do it. Then what? You forget about recovery and God and helping others? A primary purpose, they sober work with another drunk. This is what I get to do until God says, I don't need you doing this anymore. And that doesn't strike fear into me. I'm not even supposed to be alive and sober based on my track record. This is all bonus time. So I look at step four, and we were talking about this last week. We look at resentments, and while we're writing, we ask God for allow us to be searching, fearless, and moral. Because on my own power, I won't be. To uncover, discover, and eventually discard the things that are blocking me from this power called God. I'm a broken instrument, and I need God to fix it. I can't fix it. I don't even know what's wrong with it. I can't even see what's wrong with it, but I know it's broken. And step four allows me to go and see all the broken parts all over the floor, because on my own, I can't see it. I won't even go in and look. We get so sick, even in AA, in recovery, and defects are running our life that we become so accustomed to it. We become so used to it. It's what we are, and that's how we go. And we think this is how it's supposed to be. Same thing when we watch TV at night. You turn on CNN, and you're watching explosions and kidnappings and murders, and let's see what else is on. If someone just landed on this planet and saw that kind of headline, they'd go, oh my God. We need to do something. This is awful. You guys are dropping bombs on each other. People are at war. What's wrong with you? We just keep flicking because we've become used to it, which is more dangerous than anything. In recovery, we walk with defects. We walk with fear. We walk with an ego. We walk with this broken spirit, if you will, in a sense, and we become used to it. Have another cup of coffee. Go see another speaker. And never once do we get, we can be here for a long time, do we get right, comfortable, at ease with God and others. We're always looking for something, many of us, just something to lock into. Give me some drama to lock into so I have something going, because God forbid I should go home and look at me in the mirror and take stock of me. Step four eliminates that. It says we're taking stock of you, Peter, And there's no way around this. And the format for the inventory doesn't allow me to point the finger. They want an example, and they go to the fourth column, and they say, Peter, where are you at fault? Even if someone did something bad to you, what was your part in this? What an order. I can't go through with it. How much do I want this God? Isn't any length. It's easy. It feels easy. It appears to be easy by just going to meetings. 3-4 meetings a day, get used to the camaraderie. It is a band-aid and open wound. It's a great thing. But at some point, I need to go home and I need to go out there. I need to earn a living. I need to play with children. I need to play with my family. I need to do things. And I fail miserably. And I start to hide out in Alcoholics Anonymous because I can't do life. We can't live life on life's terms. Inventory is going to erase all of it and allow me to stand clear in the roar in front of my God with all the broken pieces. And little by slowly, he fixes and puts them back together. And how well I'm going to get is really on God. My job is to chop wood and carry wood and stand before my Creator as ready as I can possibly be, which means I need to do some work. Which means I'm going to bring a pick and shovel to the mountain. And I'm going to get some blisters. I'm going to break a sweat. It's the chop wood and carry wood of you. So we look at inventory, and after prayer, I would write all the people I'm resentful at. Do you ever notice when you're in a place of resentment that after a while you really believe that you're right and they're wrong? In fact, we even think that God is resentful with you at that person. God agrees with me. I should shoot him. You know? And we do stuff like that. I would say, well, he was wrong. But if he didn't do this, I would have never done that. And the God agrees with me, so therefore you should be punished. That's what resentments do. It's the number one offender. Our book says it destroys more alcoholics than anything else. Not booze. It says resentment because it blocks me from this power called God. If I'm walking around with a couple of hundred resentments, I have a problem. And I list resentment, cause, where I'm at fault, my third column, what it affects in me, and where I'm at fault. And I get done with this resentment inventory. All the people that I've been upset with, angry with, disturbed by even, agitated with. And it asks me to look at principles, institutions, and then we talk about fear inventory, the evil and corroding threat. And we touched on that last week. And I go through all the fears I have. Fear of dying, fear of living, fear of money, fear of no money, poor health, goes on. Fear of relationships, fear of intimacy, fear of bugs, fear of heights, whatever it might be. And when we're writing it, it seems to be, why is God giving me something that's so insignificant? You ever do a jigsaw puzzle? 1,000 little pieces? They're not that important when you're starting out. You're missing a piece when the puzzle's completed. You got a hole in the puzzle. There's something wrong with it. And we do all this writing. All of it's valid. All of it's important. It's all part of the puzzle to make me complete. And in order for me to be complete, the whole thing has to go. It's the process of removal that I experience God, never addition. The process of recovery is about subtractions, about removal, never addition. And so I would list my fears. Same way I did for my resentment. Fear, why do I have this fear? What did the fear hurt, interfere, or threaten in me? My third column. And then I take a look at where my self-reliance failed me with defects of character. Our book says fear ought to be classed with stealing. Fear is a choice. That's why it says that. I decide to go steal. I can turn to God or feed off of this fear. What do? Fear, I know. Let's go do it. When I got my back against the wall, the knee-jerk reaction for many of us is to control it, to take over, to arrest the fear. But who's in charge of that? The same mind that created the fear in the first place. And God, suddenly there's this thing out there that's not very tangible. I have some skepticism and doubt. Yet if I lock into God and just be still, it'll always work out the way God has worked out for me. Do you ever like not do something and an hour later go, it's a good thing I didn't do anything? How many times have we had our backs against the wall with fear? And we say, I'm never going to get out from under this. And 6 months later, 3 months later, we get out. We say, wow, it worked out okay. In fact, it's a blessing in disguise. You ever hear that one? That was a blessing in disguise. And then we hit new fear, but we forget about how God bailed us out in the past. And we put our hands on the wheel and keep hitting walls. fear the evil and corroding threat. It has free room and board in my mind with the martini, and it doesn't want to leave. It drives me. Fear drives me. Anger insists I'm right. What's behind anger is fear all the time. The entire inventory, if we look at our four steps and we open it up and dissected it, one word will come out of the entire inventory: fear. That's why our book says it's the evil and corroding threat. Fear. When we're speaking to someone, how do I look? How do I sound? They're talking to me and I'm worried. How do I look? How do I sound? I need to have a profound answer for them right now because I know they're judging me and I'm God. They don't know it, but I'm God. So I'm not listening to you because I'm worried about what I'm going to say. I remember one time I was working in Texas in this treatment center, working for my sponsor. And one of the texts came in and says, Mark wants to see you first thing in the morning. Well, my mind says, I'm getting fired. And I tossed and turned all night. I prayed like throughout the night. I was chanting. And I walked in and my sponsor says, you thought you're getting fired. And he left. He said, I'm giving you a raise. You're doing great work. And that was it. He said, now get out of here. But that's what we do. I squandered the hours that may have been worthwhile. Right? Worrying is not going to add a day to my life. And I forget the exact quote, but that's what the carpenter said. Right? The present moment's always in the way. And then I look at this other piece called the sex inventory. Uh-oh, we got to talk about that. Right? And here's where everyone gets really uncomfortable and squirrely. We're going to talk about sex now. And it's not only sex, but it's my ideas of how a man should be, my ideas of how a woman should be, and we have a really thorough inventory about that. One of the things I learned in answering the questions in the big book, did I cause any harm based on my behavior, not only to the person I was with, but I had to look around the relationship, right? Here's what I was told to do. Did I believe I need an overhauling in the area of sex in my life? Absolutely. Do I believe we all have sex problems? We'd hardly be human if we didn't. Absolutely. Not the right kind, too little, too much, the wrong person. It goes on and on and on. I'm not man enough. She's not woman enough. Yet we're married. We have a problem. The most intimate act of love with someone I want to spend the rest of my life with, I have a problem with. We have a problem. And it's not a problem with them. It's my mind telling me how they should be, how I'm supposed to be. All the guys know, as soon as it comes to that, we're supposed to be studs. 2 minutes later, we're smoking a cigarette. It's over. What are you looking at me for? Everybody's going to speak for yourself, right? I'm trying to make the sex inventory light here, guys. We have these roles that we assign ourselves and the other person. My biggest problem was I grew up 60s and 70s, and a woman's place was in the home. Men are the king of the castle, so to speak. I grew up, it was so screwed up that I remember I was dating a girl and she was going to go to college. And I said, college? A woman going to college? What's wrong with her? She's not a nice girl. This is why I was having problems in personal relationships. I was coming from that kind of upbringing and my family's predominantly men. We were told certain things on how a man's supposed to be, and then I start to socialize and date. I was having problems in relationships. It was all twisted up. I had to take a look at that. How I'm supposed to be, how I'm supposed to sound. A real man has lots of money. A real man owns things. A real man never has fear. A real man is always convinced, always sure what he needs to do. I was fear-based, insecure, and an alcoholic in the making. I could fit none of those roles. And we start to internalize that, and we start to bury it, and we start to need a drink just to walk out the door because I can't be a real man. My dad was like, you know, John Wayne. I can't live up to that. How do I'm a mistake. We come to inventory, and I write down the people in my life that I've had relationships with. What was the relationship? a dating relationship, a marriage relationship, a one-night stand relationship? What was it? Let's identify it. I write a brief history of this relationship, one paragraph, what it looked like. My motives for getting involved. We were friends, we fell in love, we got married, we broke up. I was drunk, so was she. What was it about? The players are going to change. The faces and names are going to change. Me, I've never changed. 10 years, 5 years, 20 years later, it's the same exact stuff, maybe a different state, but the rhythm is still the same. There's something wrong with me. Something is broken within me, and I keep approaching new relationships with the old luggage that's never been unpacked. What were the major points that came up in the relationship? What did we fight about all the time? How was my conduct in the relationship? Where I had been selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate? Who did I hurt? Let me look around the relationship. Maybe I was dating someone who had children, and I blow that relationship up. Was it possible that the kids were hurt by my behavior too? Maybe her mom and dad were hurt by my behavior too? Maybe my parents were hurt by my behavior. I need to look around that. Right? Did I arouse jealousy, suspicion, bitterness? And the book says, where am I at fault? Back to me again. What did I do? And I look at where I'm at fault, and perhaps I owe an amends to a lot of people, maybe just not her. And I needed to take a look at this. And this is a hard pill for us to swallow, looking at the sex inventory. It's not, again, it's not just sex, it's just my ideas of how a man should be and how a woman should be. And then when we're out there, when we're drinking and drugging and running through the town, we have some things that we like to just tuck away for no one to ever hear about. Bad judgment calls, I'll call them, okay? We all have, well, most of us have some of that. Somebody needs to know about that, a sponsor. We don't have to broadcast it to a room, but a sponsor. Some of us rather go to our religious community and sit on, like in a confession, say, here's where I missed the mark here. But it needs to go. It needs to go, because if not, it's going to erode the spiritual progress. It's a cancer that's sitting there. No cancer is good. This stuff is like a cancer. We suffer from a terminal illness. Chuck Chamberlain talked about this years ago. What we have alcoholism is a terminal illness. It's going to kill us. And we will get incredibly ill without even picking up a drink. So we put this all on paper. And when it's all done, they ask me to write a sex goal and ideal for my future sex life. How I should be. Looks like the opposite where I was missing the mark. Maybe integrity, loyalty, compassion, a servant, understanding. Some humility in a relationship. What I can bring to someone. That's all God. That it's not about me anymore. In a relationship, it's not about me. It's about what can I bring to it. Chuck Chamberlain said every morning when he woke up to a new woman. And he was married forever to the same woman. He woke up every morning. But because he was so present, he felt like he woke up to someone new. It's a new day, a new breath, a new experience, and full of gratitude and humility, because he knew he was just an alcoholic. He's above ground, sucking air and sober. He's on bonus time. And he brought that to everything he did. That's all God stuff. But if I'm running the show, if I'm in my own way, I can't do that. Because you have to give me something. I did good for you, now give me something, is how the world operates usually. I did you a favor, now you do for me. Right? My God did nothing but serve. In Alcoholics Anonymous, all I need to do is serve. We can claim God with our lips, but we're always expecting to get. And really, if we're messengers of God, we're not here to be served, but to serve. And sometimes when we serve, it doesn't taste good. It doesn't even feel good. But it's what we're supposed to be doing. Right? So I finished this entire fourth step, and now comes a day I need to go sit with this guy who I call the sponsor. And up until then, my sponsor invented Alcoholics Anonymous. He probably even walked on water at some point, right? And was probably seated at the Last Supper. I know this for sure. And then I had to sit with him with my fifth step, and I went, who is this guy? Who is this guy? And I need to go share this stuff. And how am I going to share a sex inventory? And I was getting really uncomfortable about it. And I remember I hit my knees and I prayed to my God. I said, Father, I don't want to drink anymore. Please get me to Tony's house. And I sat in prayer. And next thing I know, I was knocking on the door and he invited me in and we did some prayer. And we read out of our book a little bit and we got still. And he says, go. And he had a notepad and pen out. And I began to share with him. I started with inventory. I started to share, He was looking bored most of the time, but every once in a while he would stop me and clarify things for me. Tweak it a little bit. Kind of go under the covers a little bit more. And it came time I had to share with him about something that was very, very delicate, very, very sensitive. And that was when I was 8 and 10 being touched inappropriately by someone. I said, well, here it goes. And he says, me too. What do you mean? Me too. And he shared with me, and suddenly I was not alone anymore. I never forget that little turn the car made in my life. I was not alone. Another man experienced this, and he shared with me, and it was free. It was easier for me, and I felt freer to share the rest of it. And I went through fear inventory, and I got to sex inventory, and I was very uncomfortable about it, and he recognized that. And I did some more inventory, and I came back, and I reported to him what God gave me, and little by slowly I got out. And people were telling me, you're going to take a leap of faith in step 5. Always using this term, leap of faith, leap of faith, leap of faith, and I challenged that. I've challenged that forever. To me, there's no such thing as a leap of faith. And you can buy into this or not, but here's my experience. There's no such thing as a leap of faith. Leap of faith is riddled with fear. And if I have God, there is no fear. My mind has fear. My mind manufactures fear. What leap of faith? Who gave me the intuitive thought to go from here to there? God. Who's in the middle of this so-called leap? God. And who's waiting for me on the other end? God. And if I fall, who's going to pick me up? God. In God's world, there is no gravity. There is no leap of faith. It's going from here to there. And I look back and I say, oh my God, why was I so afraid? It wasn't that bad after all. It was pretty, in fact, I feel great about what just took place. We always get cleansed. We always get healed. We always get right sized. And the process of recovery in the removal is about removal. It's experiencing the death of self before the physical death. There's a squeezing that goes on going through the archway, and it's right here in 4 and 5. We push the mind aside, we take our inventory, not anyone else's, regardless of what they did to us, and then in the process of confession, we share it with someone else. Another alky who's walked the path hears it. And some of us will take this even to our religious communities. Here's what we do. My lineage, we do, it says personal persons in step 5. Multiple 5th steps. So I sit with someone that my sponsor assigns to me who's on this path, and I read the entire work to him. And then I go sit with my sponsor. So now 2 people who are on this path know about me. And the more people who know about me, who understand this, the freer I am. And that's what I would do. And I've done it with a few people before I sat with my sponsor and got freer. It was uncomfortable. And every time I go do a 5th step, I'm hoping that person or my sponsor is not going to be there that day because I know I'm going to be made uncomfortable. I'm uncomfortable all the way there. But what do? I go back to God. Father, please just get me there for the courage, strength, and direction to show up at this man's house and purge. And the same way when we're writing and stuff is flowing off the pen, when the pen is turned into a spiritual translator, when you're doing inventory, it just starts to flow and you can't stop it. It's coming. Here it comes and here, and my sponsor's getting it and he's breaking it down. That's a God movement because we're doing things that we should never be able to do. It's God doing for us what we can't do for ourselves, huh? And in that process, we all have that thing... that hurt, I talked about that a couple of weeks ago. We've got the things that when we talk about it, we get a lump in our throat. We get really uncomfortable. We're full of guilt and shame, remorse, anger. We just want to crawl under a chair. We don't want to talk about it. We all got that thing. I hurt someone or they hurt me. Whatever form it came in. A huge disappointment, a heartbreak. Sexual, physical, verbal abuse. It's part of our story. It isn't who we be. And for so long we walked around thinking that's who we are. That's not who we are. with children of a loving God. And inventory allows me to get to a place of understanding I'm one with my Creator. And those are things that happen to me by sick players. In fact, we can even go to a place that the people who've harmed us, we learn to forgive them. Forgive them, for they know not what they do. I don't like what you did, but I forgive you. Then I'm free. No one has pull on me anymore. What an order. I can't go through that. We're talking about God now. We're not talking about me. We're not talking about you as an individual. We're talking about God. If we all got together and push on those closet doors, we'd knock them down in a second. We'd blow these doors right open. We're all together. Can you imagine the power of God to give me a spirit of willingness to forgive someone? It's an easy task. Who's in the way? Me. Who's in the way? My mind. Who's in the way? My belief systems and my attachments to all of them. In step five, it says, we've been trying to get a new attitude and a new relationship with our Creator. What's my current attitude towards this power? A new attitude is one that's clean, that's clear, that's open. And a new relationship, because the one that I was using in the past either was non-existent or things were blocking me from experiencing this God. And my goal is to get clear, to get right with God. And I need to sit with someone and disclose what's going on within me. My fifth step in the big book tells me if I don't do this step, I may not overcome drinking. One of the most clear-cut warnings in the entire book. So I can go from meeting to meeting to meeting to meeting, but if I'm not doing this work and sharing a fifth step, they used to tell me, if you don't do a fifth, you'll drink one. Meetings don't fix alcoholism because it's a bunch of human powers. We need God. It's a band-aid on an open wound. We come here. It's a band-aid on an open wound, and it's sacred. But at some point, we need to develop a relationship with our God. And I've gone through this fifth step many times. I've gone through the work I don't know how many times. Because I can't rely on an old experience to be current today. Had a spiritual experience 20 years ago. What am I doing now? Relying on the old experience? My sponsor said to me, did you eat today? I said, yeah. He says, why? You ate yesterday. Right? I can't rely on yesterday's lunch to keep me hungry. Right? I had a lunch at work today. I'm hungry right now. I'm going to eat later. What do we do for our soul food? Well, I prayed last week. I did an inventory 20 years ago. I went through the work a long time ago. How am I doing now? I'm relying on an old experience that's now rusty. I'm doing it from memory with a lot of other things that have gotten in the way to be present to the moment and an effective spiritual agent for God. I'm falling short. I'm missing the mark. It's constant vigilance, growing and understanding and effectiveness. When men come to me to share their fourth step and the fifth step process. I do what was taught to me. I have a notepad and pen in front of me. And I go hide out before they show up. I do pray, do some meditation, and be clear so I can hear. Need to be clear so we can hear. And that requires me getting right with God. And whether I go to their house or they come to me, I go with a notepad and pen and I'm still. I read a little something. We make some prayer. I usually carry this religious article. I ask them if it's okay to put on a table. And off we go. And I start taking notes as they read. And it's really important that I tell them, do not elaborate unless I ask you to. You know how we are. Resentment Joe did this. Let me tell you what happened here. Like 3 days later, I'm in the same, And we become right, and that person becomes even more wrong. So I ask them, God gave you this. Just read what God gave you. And if I feel a need to stop, I will. And I start taking some notes as they're reading. Every once in a while, I'll stop them and say, you know something? Back on page one, you had this thing. We're in page 20 now, the same thing. Different players, same behavior. Same defect running through your life, not even aware of it. My friend Otto always says, you can't see your ears. You know they're there. I can't see my ears. You can. Same thing with the illness. You can't see it. I can. So things get exposed there. and a sponsor goes in and becomes our compass, and we get through this. And when I'm done with step five, I usually have a bunch of list of defects for them that they're going to take into step six and seven. And the defects of character that are left over in six and seven become our first step for life. These are the things that are killing us. These are the things that we couldn't see. And a lot of the defects of character we're more than willing to let go of. But there are a few that many of us will hold on to because it's the only thing we know. One of the belief systems I was brought up by a loving parent was the only thing, he says, the only thing you trust when you get older is the money in your pocket. You trust no one. And there was no real discussion of God in my house. So growing up, if I didn't have a lot of money, I was in a lot of trouble. I had nothing to trust. So it was about getting money. And I had to let go of that lack of trust in people. The belief systems I were told, don't trust men, but never trust a woman. Can't trust men, never trust. How am I supposed to have healthy relationships? But I honored that, and I would fight that. Now they're asking me to let go of distrust in all my affairs. And trust. Trust this creator that you can't see yet. And trust other people, because God works through people. What an order. I can't go through with it. It wasn't a leap of faith. There was more freedom in that than anything else. So I had this list of defects. I give it to the men the way I do when I go home. And what we do is we have a list of defects. And they surrender those things to God. Never petition God, but surrender. Father, this was revealed to me. List of defects. And I offer them to you. I'm willing to cut every one of these loose. And what we write down on the same sheet of paper is the opposite of the defects. Dishonesty, honesty. Self-centered, God-centered. Hate, love. And we offer those to God. And those are the things that God gave us at the beginning. We're full of greed and lust and envy and sloth and all of that. We're full of love and compassion. We need to return home. Six and seven is about returning home to the place that God had us at the beginning. I became what I became. We go home. And I get to see six and seven as my first step for life. Because those defects, if I don't go to God and surrender them to God, not a petition, but a surrendering to God, and have God deal with them, those defects will deal with me. One quick story. I always like to share this because I really got to experience when I talk about the death of self. I got my instructions and I did some prayer meditation for six and seven. And in the meditation, I got God save me from me. And I realized I'm my biggest enemy, no one else. But I start to feel really sick. Like I was vibrating on the inside. And I always share this story. It was like I never walked into an AA meeting, never did steps, never prayed. Like your first day in AA, you're vibrating. And I felt sick. I felt like I was dying and something was wrong. And I wasn't thinking about a drink. I was just feeling ill. This is right in the middle of six and seven. And I remember calling up my sponsor, Mark, and I says, here's what's going on. I just shared this the other day. And he says to me, it sounds like you're having an experience and hung up the phone. And I was annoyed. I want to say, identify your feelings for me. You know, let's talk, let's process your feelings today. Anyone's in a treatment center business, they know what I'm talking about. Okay. What he did was what Dr. Silkworth did when he saw Bill having an experience. He says, hold on to it. It's better than what you had, and left the room. He didn't give him a prescription. He didn't say, let's medicate you. He didn't say anything. He got out of there. And that's what Mark did to me. Mark recognized exactly that. I was experiencing the death of self. I was experiencing this God experience. It didn't feel good because it was new. And I felt like, oh my God, I'm dying. I was. The death of self for successful living. And he didn't want to get in there and start breaking it down and explain it to me, because then my mind would have got involved and the experience would have gone out the window. I would have tried to interpret everything as we do with our mind, try to rationalize everything, even with God, with my mind, and everything would have gone by the board. God just, Mark just left it alone. What came out of that was a renewing of me. I said this last week, can never be renewed of the flesh, but we can be reborn or renewed from the spirit out. I'd never been the same after that experience, but going through it, it was God-awful. But God orchestrated the entire move. It's interesting in 6 and 7, when we get there, it says this, if we can answer to our satisfaction, the question's on page 75, to our satisfaction. When we hit 6 and 7, it's about us and God now. I don't need to check in with the sponsor. I don't need to check in with the home group. It's me and God. We've had a shift of consciousness between 5 and 6. A deeper level of consciousness. A God experience is happening. It may be the infancy of one, but it's happening nonetheless. And the sponsor, the guru, the enlightened one, whatever you think of your sponsor, they may be the advanced kind of life God, and I'm a novice who's paddling, but we are in the same water. And it's a matter of time, if I keep paddling, I will be the life God. And I'll have a newbie in the water saying, keep coming. And he knew that. The importance of sponsorship in AA. It's the person I'm going to go to, my point person, to lead me out of this mess and to experience God's abundance. I'm out of time. Thank you.